Obama, you know, he was the perfect spokesman for the liberal wing of the national security state, and he was the perfect moderate cover for its radical ambitions. And when Obama came in, he declared, sure, we tortured some folks. Look, let me be clear, we tortured some people. Hey, he acknowledged some mistakes. Iraq was a stupid war. To paraphrase F. Scott Fitzgerald on British Empire, Obama was like an aristocrat who, after a disastrous orgy, apologized individually to each and every man and woman involved, not out of sincere shame, but to restore his honor and the power he previously enjoyed. Of course, he did so on behalf of the American Empire, which replaced the British Empire. And then he delivered a speech in Oslo after winning a Nobel Prize for Peace on why we need to go to war.
Listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to the Cascadia Film Arts Festival, Living in a Nuclear Landscape. My name is Laura Feldman, one of the organizers of this festival, which was initially scheduled to take place in early April. But like many events, it was canceled due to the pandemic. However, we had drawn together some amazing artists and activists for this festival, and we really wanted to share some of the work that these brilliant women have done and are doing. So, as part of this year's 75th memorial to the victims of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we want to join with Oregon PSR in bearing witness to the incalculable costs of living in a nuclear landscape. And so it's my great pleasure to introduce Tricia Pritikin. She is president of CORE, Consequences of Radiation Exposure. She's an attorney, a downwinder, and author of The Hanford Plaintiffs, Voices from the Fight for Atomic Justice. So welcome, Tricia. It's so good to have this opportunity to talk to you, with you, about your new book.
Oh, Laura, thank you so much. Thanks for the nice introduction. And I'm just so happy to have everyone here. We've got Karen Dorn Steele, from former investigative reporter of the Spokesman Review. We've got Tom Bailey. We've got Bob McCormick. And it's just a great group. And I'm really thankful for all the work you put in to have this happen. I'm going to just lay a little bit of introduction for the readers, for the viewers or listeners about Hanford, because not everyone has heard of Hanford, nor do they know where it's located or what it did. So many people are not aware of a very disturbing historic link between the Pacific Northwest, the Manhattan Project, and the atomic destruction of Nagasaki. Hanford was a wartime production site for the Manhattan Project. Located on the Columbia River within the U.S. Pacific Northwest, it manufactured the plutonium for Fat Man, the atomic bomb that destroyed Nagasaki on August 9, 1945. This instantly killed 70,000 people, along with thousands of more people who died over the following months and years from radiation poisoning. Beginning in late 1944 and continuing for more than 40 years during the Cold War, Hanford secretly irradiated much of the Pacific Northwest through releasing airborne radioactive gases and particles, which were the radioactive byproducts of plutonium production at the facility. The fallout from Hanford spread throughout eastern Washington, northern Oregon, Idaho, western Montana, and into southern British Columbia. Operators of the facility also dumped liquid and solid radionuclides into the Columbia River, potentially harming the health of downriver communities within Washington and Northern Oregon. And we actually have Bob McCormick here today, whose mother grew up on the shores of the Columbia River within Oregon. He's going to be telling us quite a devastating story of the health impact of exposures on his family. The public did not learn about Hanford's downwind and downriver releases of ionizing radiation until 1986, which was a full 42 years after these releases began. And it was primarily the courageous reporting of Karen Dorn Steele, former investigative journalist with the Spokane Spokesman Review, that alerted the public to the hidden dangers of Hanford. And I'm really honored to have Karen with us today. I'm so glad you could be here, Karen. Your story is so important, and it started everything for it. It really, without your reporting, I am wondering if the Department of Energy would have ever revealed that it released this radiation for so many years. Now, in the mid-1980s, Steele began to write news stories describing cancers in members of farm families across from the Hanford facility and heart attacks in young men who worked the fields. In a Spokesman Review story on July 28, 1985, entitled "The Night the Little Demons Were Born," Steele described the horrendous births of hundreds of grotesquely deformed lambs, many that did not survive, within Hanford area farms. These deformed lambs and their lambing ewes that also suffered and died were identical to the grotesquely deformed lambs and their lambing ewes that died in Cedar City, Utah, downwind of the Nevada test site following exposure to fallout from an atomic test in the early 1950s. Now, as a result of Steele's stories, public concern grew over whether perhaps an undisclosed nuclear accident had taken place at Hanford in one of its 9 production reactors, resulting in the release of radiation downwind. Public pressure began to mount, and Freedom of Information Act requests were filed demanding disclosure from Hanford facility operators. In 1986, the Department of Energy was finally forced to declassify early operating records, revealing that rather than an isolated nuclear accident, decades of continuous secret offsite radiation releases had happened. On this, the 75th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, I would ask that we commemorate not only the Japanese victims of the bombings, but as well the overlooked American civilian infants, children, and adults exposed to radioactive fallout downwind of Hanford and the other Manhattan Project sites where the bombs were produced. I am one of those civilians. We are sometimes referred to as downwinders. I'm also one of the plaintiffs in the Hanford downwinder litigation. I was born and raised in Richland, Washington, the community closest to the Hanford site. And like many others who were children within Hanford's radioactive shadow, I now suffer from radiation-caused diseases, including thyroid disease, precancerous thyroid nodules, 2 additional autoimmune diseases, and chronic fatigue-like symptoms. I developed hypoparathyroidism, which is a serious disease that leads to kidney failure and seizures, when 3 of 4 of my parathyroid glands were lost during a thyroidectomy to stop the spread of thyroid cancer. Native American communities throughout Hanford's radioactive downwind regions, along with migrant and resident farm workers, were potentially exposed to the most significant levels of radiation due to time spent out of doors, contact with the soil, and other lifestyle factors, including the consumption of wildlife and whole fish containing radionuclides released from Hanford. In 1991, along with almost 5,000 other people whose health was damaged by childhood exposure to Hanford radiation, I filed a personal injury tort suit against former contractors who had operated Hanford during my childhood. The mass toxic tort litigation is referred to in re Hanford Nuclear Reservation Litigation, or in re Hanford for short. The litigation dragged on for an incredible 25 years. And throughout that time, only 3 bellwether, that is representative plaintiffs, had the chance to share their stories before a jury of their peers. Thousands of downwinders' stories remain to be told. When the final meager settlements in the litigation were sent out to plaintiffs in late 2015, as the litigation grew to a close, I knew that the suffering of civilian downwinders of the Pacific Northwest would soon vanish from public memory, and I could not let that happen. So I made it my mission to record at least some of the stories of those who had not had the opportunity to speak on the record. With the help of plaintiff's counsel, Tom Folds of the Hanford Litigation Office in Seattle, and Richard Iman of Iman, Allison, Jones in Spokane, I reached out to the final group of plaintiffs who were going to receive settlement checks from the contractors. These two firms sent out a letter inviting these downwinder clients to participate in my effort to collect their stories. The result is 24 plaintiffs whose stories appear in the Hanford Plaintiffs Voices from the Fight for Atomic Justice, which was published earlier this year by the University Press of Kansas. I used up all the funds that I had received from my meager personal injury settlement to travel to meet with nearly everyone. These were farmers like Tom Bailey, who you will hear from today. These were children like Charlotte Ray McCormick and her siblings, who'd grown up downriver from Hanford in Oregon, swimming and boating in the radioactive waters of the Columbia, as the public had no idea that these waters were radioactive. You will hear from Charlotte's son, Bob, today. And these were children of an anthropologist who was excavating the site of the Whitman Mission near Walla Walla. These were also the children of Hanford workers. We offer our damaged bodies and often foreshortened lives as living proof of the human toll of production and testing of nuclear weapons. Our collective testimony demonstrates in no uncertain terms the incompatibility of human life and well-being with production and testing of nuclear weapons.
Thank you, Tricia. Where can people order this book?
There are two bookstores in Portland in particular where people can find this book. The first is the Two Rivers Bookstore at 8836 North Lombard, and the number there is 971-865-5941. Second location is Passages Bookshop at 1223 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, Portland, phone number 503-388-7665.
Wonderful. And Tricia, can you tell us a little bit about CORE, the nonprofit to which net proceeds from this book are dedicated?
I can. Thanks, Laura, very much. CORE, which stands for Consequences of Radiation Exposure, was incorporated in late 2015 at the close of the Hanford Downwinder litigation. Its mission is to advance and disseminate the understanding of the human toll of exposure to ionizing radiation from uranium mining, milling or transport, nuclear weapons production, testing or use in warfare, or nuclear reactor offsite releases and related radiation exposures. We have a website which is found at www.corehanford, that's one word, corehanford.org. First, my friend and hero, Karen Dorn Steele. I mean, without Karen's work, I don't know if the story of Hanford would have ever been made public. And thank you for being here, Karen. I'm just going to hand it over to you and let you tell your story, please, of how you became aware of the Hanford story.
Thanks, Tricia. Yeah, let me set the context a bit for how I got involved with Hanford. I was hired by the Spokesman Review in 1982. I'd already had a decade of experience with Washington Public Television, the Spokane Public Television Station, where I was at an on-air public affairs show. But they hired me as a special projects and investigative reporter. And this was the early 80s, so the atmosphere is important to this story. Ronald Reagan has been elected president, and he has announced that a major new nuclear weapons buildup to counter Soviet aggression. And he announced plans to reopen Purex, which was a mothballed 1956 weapons plant at Hanford. Sounds like a bleach plant, Purex, when I first heard it. But it is actually an acronym for plutonium uranium extraction. It was one of those weapons machines that were used earlier in the 50s to make plutonium. Purex reopened then in 1983 and immediately began to have problems with too high radiation releases that violated worker safety standards by 10 to 100 times. So I began to report on these safety violations at this reopened plant. And the next year, I got a phone call from a nervous woman that would shape my journalism career for the next two decades. She told me she worked at Purex, and she was risking her security clearance by contacting me. She said the plant was having serious production problems, and she feared a worst-case scenario, an explosion that could release highly dangerous plutonium. She said to me, "We're going to blow up Pasco one of these days," which is one of the Tri-Cities and next to Hanford. And that certainly got my attention. This was 2 years before the tragic Chernobyl explosion in Ukraine. And my newspaper, the Spokesman Review, had never really covered Hanford. We'd had Associated Press stories about plants opening and closing, but we'd never actually done any enterprise reporting. But I convinced my editors to let me go down and check out the Purex stories. So I drove to Pasco, talked to this woman for hours, and she gave me a roadmap for the story, how to find out if it was really true that 40 kilograms of plutonium was missing from this plant. So I used the Freedom of Information Act, and the FBI confirmed they indeed had launched an inquiry. It was called a MUF, Materials Unaccounted For. Unaccounted for could have meant stolen, or it could have meant actually that the plant was in danger of an explosion, because you don't want plutonium building up in the nooks and crannies where an explosion could occur. So that document request brought me smack dab up with the national security side of Hanford when FBI agents visited my editor's office asking what I was doing, trying to report this story. But we did report it. And after that, the Tri-Cities officialdom started criticizing my newspaper as being anti-Hanford, anti-patriotic. Why are they doing these stories? Exposure of these of the Purex problems started to trigger a whole series of calls from people worried about Hanford's safety. And obviously this was a big controversy throughout the Pacific Northwest, because resumed weapons production at Hanford meant a renewed nuclear arms race, and many people were against that. But that led me to the next fascinating phase of this story, which for me was meeting Tom Bailey. I'd actually met Tom Bailey in Spokane at a cocktail party for our congressman, Tom Foley, who later became Speaker of the House of Representatives and was a very powerful politician in Washington, D.C. But at this cocktail party, I started asking Tom, who told me he lived right across the river from Hanford, and I asked him, well, have there been any problems there? I've been reporting on Purex, and did he know anything about that? Had there been any problems at all? And he said, oh, they only kill a few of our sheep now and then. And it was kind of a joke, but on the other hand, I was really intrigued. What did he mean by that? So Tom invited me down to the little farming town of Mesa, Washington, across the river from Hanford, to meet a lot of his neighbors. They had never met a reporter before. They were not the kind of people who talked to the press at all. And his wife Linda didn't want him to invite me, but he did it anyway. And my editors were skeptical as to whether there would be a story there, because Hanford had always said everything that had happened at Hanford had been perfectly safe. But they let me go down, and Tom introduced me to many of his neighbors, including a farming couple, Juanita and Leon Andrew Jeske, who I found out that had been keeping a death map. They were so concerned about cancers and other early illnesses, early heart attacks in their community, that they had been tracking as best they could what had happened to people. So as Tricia mentioned, my first story on the farmers and their concerns was published in July of 1985, and the headline was Downwinders Living with Fear. And I just want to read the first paragraph of that story, because it became kind of prescient later on. Farmer Tom Bailey stood amid shoulder-high corn on a bluff overlooking the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. He pointed down to a wide valley at Ringgold, where farms descend to the Columbia River. As a dust storm swept a huge brown cloud across the nuclear reservation, Bailey remarked, "This is the funnel, and we're the Hanford downwinders." That two-word description would stick for decades. Hanford civilian victims would, from that date on, be described as Hanford downwinders. Other of his neighbors described mysterious sheep deaths, as Tricia has mentioned, sheep deaths in the early 60s, strange mummified lambs being born, and over 100 of them in this farming community with no explanation as to what happened. The sidebar story on that was called The Night the Little Demons Were Born, because Farmer Nels Allison described them as looking like little demons, really strangely deformed. And the mother ewes died as well in this mass die-off of lambs. At that time, there was no evidence at all of a connection But they suspected, the farmers suspected, that there might have been a radiation leak from Hanford at that time. They recalled seeing in the 60s, and actually earlier, even in the late 50s, radiation monitors from Hanford going through their fields dressed in protective gear and masks and picking up soil, picking up things out of the soil. But the Hanford people didn't tell them what they were doing, and they never got any explanation either for what they were looking for in the fields or for the sheep deaths. And so I began to study and read, and I found out that a very similar thing had happened down in Nevada after the open air, some of the dirtiest of the open air weapons tests at the Nevada test site, where thousands of sheep died. And the sheep men queried the Atomic Energy Commission about it, and the Atomic Energy Commission denied any link. In fact, they called them dumb sheep men. Denied any link between the sheep deaths and the open air blasts. But we learned much later, and Tricia writes about this in the book, that there was an experimental secret sheep lab at Hanford feeding sheep radioactive iodine to test what would happen to those sheep. The farmers didn't know that at the time. I didn't know that until much later. But there was a definite Hanford link to the Nevada test site story, and certainly raises grave questions about what happened just right across the river from Hanford. So this triggered these stories about the farmers and Tom Bailey's neighbors triggered a lot of interest. And of course, we, not only me, but other reporters in the Northwest, in Seattle, Portland, started looking for documents. And we asked, well, I asked the Hanford officials, have you ever studied any of these people across the river, or anybody, any civilians in the area? And they said, Don Ellie, who was their radiological safety chief at the time, told me, well, we wouldn't study these people because we wouldn't expect to see anything. But what really gave a lie to this is that when we went to ask for the environmental monitoring documents from 1944 through the 1950s and the 1960s, we learned that most of them were still classified. That was stunning. I mean, this was 40 years after, you know, some of these events. Why were these documents still classified? So we, along with some other newsletter outlets and an environmental group in Washington, D.C., filed the massive Freedom of Information Act request to get these documents declassified. And there was a huge battle at the Department of Energy in Washington, D.C. about this. Admiral James Watkins, who was Ronald Reagan's energy secretary at the time, said, if those documents were released, that would effectively forever curtail the production of nuclear weapons because what they would reveal. And as Tricia has said, we succeeded in getting many of the documents, not all of them. And the first big release was in March of 1986. And when Mike Lawrence, the operation manager at Hanford, handed out these piles to reporters, 19,000 pages of documents. He said, well, he was asked first about, he first said that the current operations were safe. But of course, the obvious question is, well, what about the past? What about the 40s, 50s, and 60s? And he said, I'm gonna leave that up to others to decide. Well, that was a clue right there. We started crunching the data, and as it turned out, the Hanford releases turned out to be the largest releases of any U.S. nuclear weapons facility, at least a million curies of radioactive iodine-131. But how do you put that in context? Well, look at Three Mile Island, the commercial nuclear accident in Pennsylvania in 1979. In that accident, 12 to 24 curies of iodine-131 were released, and the entire rural area was evacuated, and milk from dairy cows in the area was impounded. So there were safety precautions that were taken. None of that happened at Hanford. The farmers were never warned, milk was never impounded, and nobody knew. It was kept a complete secret. The only people that knew that this was happening were the Atomic Energy Commission in Washington, D.C., and the operators, the top operators of the Hanford facility.
The next person who we'll hear from is Tom Bailey, that who Karen described several times. He had a very important role in the early days when Karen was just discovering the story. And I'm so glad Tom's with us today. So you'll hear from Tom next. He lived on a farm. He was born and raised right across the river from the Hanford production facility and has been a farmer his whole life. And he has been there the entire time, and his testimony is a testimony to the story. Tom, are you ready to share your story?
I suppose. I want to make one correction about the milk testing. They did test our milk on a weekly basis. And they always just told us, we'll tell you if there's anything wrong. But they came to the farms every week and collected milk samples out of the tank at the farm, because the milk was mixed when it went to Twin City Creamery. So with that background, I'll reinforce what Karen said about they tested our soil. They were always around. Some of my first memories of seeing soldiers walking behind guys in spacesuits with shovels, scooping up dirt and putting them in a gunny sack. I thought Buck Rogers had landed on face Earth. That was in the 1940s. I guess I better talk about my health effects. My mother had a stillborn, my brother was stillborn. I was born with birth defects. My sisters have all had cancer. My mother and father died of cancer. All my father's four brothers died of cancer. His parents died of cancer. And his sister died of cancer. We all laid out of the same garden. We drank the same milk. I was a very unhealthy baby. I had sores. I lost my hair three different times. I had paralysis. I was in a polio ward for 3 months in an iron lung. Came out of that. No effects from the polio, so I don't suspect it was polio. It was something else. And just lived a miserable childhood.
I wanted to know if you would be willing to talk a little bit about how resistant your neighbors were to talking about Hanford when Karen came out. Were they welcoming to having a reporter there, or were they resisting that?
Well, they sure liked talking to Karen in the beginning. Everybody was wide open and happy to visit with her and laugh about the deformed sheep. Hmm. The boy, when that downwinder story came out, when her story broke, man, I was a pariah in the community. They didn't like me at all. I had lots of problems. Threats, shut up, don't talk like that, you ruin the economy. Bill Bouquet, the local editor of the Tri-City Herald, wrote an editorial calling us downwinders, low-use segment of the population. I just tarred and feathered almost. How dare I ask about Hanford?
It must have been very hard on you for many years to have to deal with so much resistance and anger aimed at you while you were trying to just speak the truth.
It's hard to point out the truth, Tricia. And I've been raised to be tough, so I took it and went with it because I knew Karen was the light of my life. She's a shining light. Yeah, kept coming up with facts that vindicated my statements. You're my hero, Karen.
Thank you, Tom. I wanted to say something about that. Another thing about that period, it's true, you were kind of vilified down there and you got lots of the brunt of this, but do you remember that in 1989, Bill Buckley brought his show Firing Line to the Tri-Cities. He invited you to be on it, he invited me to be on it. It was to debate the subject about the safety of nuclear weapons production. And they also had an official from Hanford, one of these people that denigrated
Mike
you,
Fox.
And a guy named Michael Fox, a nuclear engineer and Hanford defender. And this show was taped before a Tri-Cities audience. And afterwards, you know, Buckley used to do these little analyses of who had the best arguments, and he said that you and I and Tim Connor of Heal had the best arguments, and he panned Michael Fox for being, quote, uneasy and evasive. So I think you won that debate. And Buckley also asked the audience, interestingly enough, there was an audience of at least 300 people there, how many of them had thyroid cancer or disease, and about two-thirds of them raised their hand. And he said he was stunned by that. He didn't say that on the show, but he said that afterwards. Wow. So this was clearly becoming a big national story when Bill Buckley shows up in the Tri-Cities.
As I recall, Tom, Connie Chung was there too on your farm, wasn't she? At some point, the reporter Connie Chung was riding on your tractor.
Yes, she came out and interviewed us.
Uh-huh. Lots of national attention. Could you talk a little bit about Death Mile? People might have heard of Death Mile and your Death Mile tour and not know what that was.
Well, Karen and I were driving down the road, and I was naming the names of the houses and the people that had cancer or deformed children. And I, all of a sudden it dawned on me. I pulled over to the side of the road and said, "Karen, that's what's wrong with me. That's what happened to my health, remember?" I was talking about it and it wasn't really sinking in. At that time, there was about 27 farmers that had health problems that were radiogenic in nature. Now, today, it's 100% all 27 of them have cancer or birth defects.
And I'll never forget meeting one of the people you introduced me to, F.R. Chen, who was a very bright guy. He was a scientist, a Chinese-American. He had raised seven kids on the Ringgold Bluff, and he worked for the Pasco Water District. And he got access to these confidential memos about radiation in the whitefish in the Columbia River that were eating radioactive moss coming out of the where the reactor effluent was going into the Columbia. But it was a big struggle for him because he stopped feeding his kids fish, which was a big part of their diet, but he couldn't tell his neighbors because they were confidential documents. And so for him, it was a huge moral dilemma, and he still felt uneasy about it when I talked to him in 1985.
You remember Nels Allison, the sheep farmer that said, "I don't drink the water, I only drink the beer, that's why I'm still alive." Well, he was right on. He said, "Them sheep looked like little demons," and that's where he got that line, remember?
Yeah, he was very forthcoming. He even gave me his farm production book, which I still
have.
That's
right.
That showed.
That's right. It showed. He had to fess up.